I'm Stephanie Potter. I'm here at KBOO in Portland, and I'm talking today with editor and publisher of The Nation, Victor Navasky, who's in New York. At 140 years old, The Nation is probably America's oldest weekly magazine, and it provides a forum of debate for the American left. Award-winning writer Victor Navasky served as editor since 1978, and he's been publisher since 1995. Mr. Navasky's latest book, A Matter of Opinion, is part memoir, part history of the magazine, and throughout it's a spirited defense for freedom of the press. And I'd like to welcome you to KBOO today. And, Victor, do I call you Victor or Mr. Navasky, by the way?
Mr. Victor. No, call me Victor.
Call me Victor. Okay. So anyway, in your preface, you have a quote from your son.
Yes.
Describing your book as a how not to.
Yes.
And what did he mean by that? And do you agree? Did you intend?
Well, you know, I started out to write a meditation on the role of magazines like The Nation, The National Review, The New Republic in this country, or The Spectator and The New Statesman in England. And in this age of conglomerated, homogenized, Murdochized, Oprahficated electronic communications, what are these artifacts of the age of print of the 18th century, or are they a counterforce to everything that's going on in the world? And I started out to do that on the theory that it was the one kind of book I could write while editing this magazine, The Nation, because I was thinking about these kinds of problems every day. But it turned out, after about 15 years of putting out this magazine every day, that I was overwhelmed with getting it out, and I never got around to sitting down and writing the book. And at about that time, my then publisher made me an offer I should have refused and sold me the magazine for money I didn't have, and I had to go out and raise a lot of money. And at that point, I changed the idea of the book from a third-person meditation to a first-person misadventure story. And when I finally got a draft together, I showed it to my son Bruno, and he read all of three pages, and then he looked up and he said, "I get it. It's a how not to." And because it chronicles all of the mistakes I've made over the years, but also it does tell you how or how not to, by implication, how to put out a magazine like this, or how to do journalism, or how to think about the relationship of the editorial side to the business side.
Actually, as I was reading it, I found it to be a very thorough how-to myself. But that aside, just to sort of maybe begin a little more with your background, because the book went a lot into about just you, too. And how would you say that your outlook as an adult was affected by your background, growing up in New York City, your father in the garment business, and the first in your family to go to college, to Swarthmore, and then to Yale Law School?
Well, my father, who was a gifted writer and a world-class reader, never was allowed to go to college because he had to go to work, and he hated business. And so when he had the chance, after his father died, he sold his interest in the family business. And part of the reason he did that was, I think, so that I would never be faced with the choice that he was faced with, or the situation he was faced with. So there would be no business for me to have to go into. But I was imbued with this literary ideal that if it were at all possible and you could be a writer or something akin to that, it was a richer, fuller, more meaningful life.
And you ended up becoming editor of The Nation. And
1978.
And yes. One thing that I sort of noticed through it, too, is that throughout it all, you have this sense of humor, this kind of rebel streak. And, for instance, like the story that you wrote about how you did your bayonet practice in the basic training. Could you just describe that for a quick moment?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of people ask me, how can you, who puts out a magazine which is so opposed to military solutions to political problems, how could you survive in the United States Army? So I tell the story. It was the end of the Korean War, so it was basically a peacetime army. But nevertheless, you had bayonet training. And in bayonet training, the whole company is lined up, and the sergeant is trying to get your adrenaline pumped up. And what you do is you charge down the field, and there are a set of dummies made of straw that are up there. And you're supposed to run at these dummies. And when you run, you're supposed to yell, "Kill, kill, kill," because this gets your adrenaline going. And then you arrive at the dummy, and you stick your bayonet in and you twist it as you yell, kill, kill, kill. So the sergeant says that, and then he says, now, some congressmen have been in touch with the company commander, the commander of the post, because some of your mothers have complained that it's offensive to have their children yelling, kill, kill, kill. So then he said, to those of you who are worried that your mommy thinks you shouldn't have to yell, kill, 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 you're allowed to say lollipop. So everybody got a big laugh. But my friend and I had a friend in the who was also a private, and we went running down the field yelling, lollipop, 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 as we plunged our bayonet in. So that was my way of dealing with this military brutality.
Yeah, I love that story, actually. And basically, then, you do describe yourself as a left liberal and a rationalist. And what do those terms mean to you?
Well, I don't know. I think that The Nation magazine, the key thing about it is that it's independent. It's really not owned by any single person. And we're set up sort of like a Broadway show where I have all the votes, but we have a bunch of shareholders who have nothing to say about what goes into the magazine. And we are a dissenting, troublemaking magazine that at this point in history happens to be on the left because the country has drifted, in my view, all the way over to the right. But we don't have a party line in our magazine. What we have are a set of arguments, debates, and conversations that are very different than you get in the mainstream press. They're not the same as, say, the debates that happen every 4 years between the Democratic and Republican presidential candidate. We'll have arguments, for example, our radical feminist readers are in deep disagreement with our civil liberty libertarian readers over an issue like pornography. Our radical feminist readers believe that it should be banned, and our civil libertarian readers believe nothing should be banned. Or our human rights interventionist writers believe that we ought to go in and to Bosnia and lift the arms embargo. Our pacifist readers believe that we shouldn't go in anywhere. Our top-down socialist planners or internationalists believe in the United Nations, which we're very sympathetic to, but our bottom-up Greens and Luddites and anarchists are very suspicious of any top-down organizations. So those kinds of issues and arguments and dialogues you don't find in other places, and my own political values are part of that discussion, and they lie in that conversation rather than in two competing visions of what national health care ought to be that divide the Democrats and Republicans.
Right. It's not so much right-left kind of arguments. It's left-left arguments in The Nation. But one of the things that sort of pervades it is a sense of, it's almost like what you call a moral force. You write that one of your all-time favorite Nation editorials was, there's no force so potent in politics as a moral issue.
Well, yeah, I think moral argument is part of the task of a magazine, of a journal of opinion like The Nation. But it's only one part of it. I mean, there are two great sentences in The Nation's history. One I quote in the front of the book, and the other you got to read into it a little further. The first one is the first sentence in the first article in the first issue of The Nation in July 6, 1865, and the sentence is, the week was singularly barren of exciting events. Now, to me, that is a really courageous sentence with which to launch a new magazine. These days, all kinds of new magazines are being started, but it would never occur to Tina Brown or the editor of Vanity Fair or whoever is trying to start something new to start a magazine with a lead sentence that devoid of buzz, of hype. And what that says to me about The Nation is that it's going to tell the truth, and it's not going to engage in this false, sensationalized game that is so pervasive in journalism today. The other sentence of The Nation's that I value is, there was a magazine called The Liberator, which was an abolitionist magazine edited by William Lloyd Garrison, and it went out of business just before The Nation started, and they gave The Nation their subscription list. And his sentence was, I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, I will not retreat a single inch. And what that is this impassioned, moral, zealous statement that we are going to fight for what we believe to be right. So if you take those two sentences. The one, we're going to tell the truth wherever it takes us. And the other, we're going to fight for what we believe to be right and social justice. Put them together, that at its best is what one hopes the nation is.
And it is a journal of opinion. It is not about objectivity or any sort of values of the center. And I think you quoted Jack Newfield, who talked about the values of the center. These other publications do actually have views and opinions. They just don't acknowledge them.
Yeah, what I say is that the nation, as you said earlier, at this point in history, is on the liberal left. If people want to attack us, which they do all the time, by the way, we've been called everything from Stalinist to neo-Stalinist to socialist to liberal to pinko to anti-Semitic to Zionist. But if they really want to insult us, they say the nation is ideological, by which they mean that we have preconceived ideas and that we report everything to fit our ideology. And my view is, yes, we are ideological, but so is everybody else. And that if you leave out inconvenient facts because you don't like where they're taking you, that's bad journalism. But if you have political values and are open about them, that can be honest journalism. And that's all ideology is that you have a set of political values that inform where you are. And what I say in the book is, so the nation, yes, has the values, the ideology of the liberal left. National Review, Bill Buckley's magazine, or the Weekly Standard, Murdoch's magazine, have the values of the conservative right. And the three networks, Time and Newsweek, the New York Times, the Portland Oregonian, they have the values of the center. They have the ideology of the center, and it is part of the ideology of the center to deny that it has an ideology. And you can find it in the language people use. I mean, why do they talk about labor problems and not management problems when there's a dispute between labor and management, because somehow there's an identification with management.
This is Stephanie Potter with KBOO. I'm talking to Victor Navasky from New York, who was editor and now publisher of The Nation magazine, and who has recently authored the book A Matter of Opinion. And Victor, you also say that opinion magazines are essential for democracy. And that includes magazines on the right for you as well as on the left.
Yes, I think that they are part of the circulatory system of a democracy and the free flow of ideas. And the founding fathers believed that newspapers, which were the equivalent of journals of opinion in those days, should be delivered free of charge. George Washington thought they should be delivered free of charge. Ben Franklin arranged, who was the postmaster, to have magazines sent free of charge. They were highly opinionated journals in those days, and the assumption of those folk was that our kind of democratic society required the free flow of ideas and argument.
And back to objectivity, you quoted, for instance, Molly Ivan saying that it's essentially impossible, but you also promote the idea of moral reason and rational debate and that kind of thing a lot. But at one point you described how the Argentinian author Jacobo Timmerman, and could you tell that story a little, like sort of the limits of reason?
Absolutely. But first come back to Molly. You know, she said there's no way in hell that she's going to see things as a white Texas woman that 49 years old, the way a 15-year-old black high school dropout does. And she says that anyone who's interviewed five eyewitnesses to an automobile accident knows there's no such thing as objectivity. Now, Timmerman is a whole different kind of story. You know, he came to this country having been this great distinguished publisher in Argentina, and he had been thrown into prison there and tortured. And he wrote a book about it called A Prisoner Without a Name, Cell Without a Number. And he came up here and was being celebrated on the one hand. On the other hand, he was also being attacked by some of his detractors from Argentina. And one day, I was supposed to have dinner with him, and we were trying to get him to write for the magazine. And an op-ed piece appeared in the New York Times by a CBS television producer saying that this guy Timmerman was a little odd because he had invited Timmerman to be on this program, and when they were talking about what he would say in advance of the program, Timmerman said, "You should torture me on television." And the producer said, no, seriously, what do you want to be asked? He said, no, torture me on television. And the producer said, you know, I explained to him, we can't do that. That'll just trivialize the terrible thing that's happened. And so I asked Timmerman that evening, what was that all about? You know, because it made him look foolish. He said, look, he said, what happened was, he said, I got to the studio and they told me, you know, the program was something like 20 minutes. And I was, you know, it was punctuated by commercials and other things. And the producer said he wanted me to tell the American people what it's like to be tortured in 5 minutes or whatever the time allotted to him was. And he said, you want to tell the American people what it's like to be tortured? Torture me on television. And he said, oh, I explained to him, don't worry. You know, I was tortured many times in prison. You can have torture doctors standing by. There are plenty of torture doctors from Brazil, from the former Soviet Union, from Argentina, from El Salvador, and they can make sure that it won't be life-threatening. And that's the way you can explain to the American people what it's like to be tortured. And so later, when the dinner was over, a lot of toasts were made. He had had his share, and I had had my share of alcohol. He put his arm around me as we're going out, and he said, so tell me, Victor, what is so terrible I be tortured on television? So, but the real moral of that for me was, how do you break through this fog of media routines and rituals and convey the horror of something like that?
Yeah, I thought that was really profound. How do you actually change consciousness? And one of the things I've sort of been interested in, are you familiar with the work of George Lakoff,
yes,
framing? And do you get the feeling sometimes that people are just sort of talking past each other's frames? Like even on your pages, like you know, Christopher Hitchens would just quit, you know, rather than continue talking. How to get people out of the space of argument and actually hearing each other?
Well, you're right. And I, you know, after I tell the Temperman story, I tell another story. We have a writer named Kirk Sale, who writes for us, and he covers what other people might call New Age stuff, so he calls cutting edge. And he was to give a talk at Town Hall. He had only 2 minutes to speak, and he had a book coming out about the Luddites, and I happened to be there. And when he got up, instead of using his 2 minutes to talk, what he did was he took a sledgehammer, and there was a computer screen on stage, and he smashed the computer screen, and it scattered shards of glass and wires and all this stuff all over the stage. And then later, I'm going to quote what he said. He said, it was astonishing how good it made me feel. He said, he can't explain it. Here he was on stage. There were 1,500 people at Town Hall, and he spoke for a minute and a half about what was wrong with the technosphere and how it was destroying the biosphere. And then he says, I walked over, I got this very powerful sledgehammer, I smashed the screen with one blow, smashed the keyboard with another blow. I felt wonderful. The sound it made, the spewing of the undoubtedly poisonous insides into the spotlight, the dust that hung in the air. Some of the audience applauded. He bowed and returned to his chair. Now, that's his statement about the machinery question. And, you know, at other forums, he had tried to discuss the importance of understanding the new technology. But at that moment, it was his way of bringing that problem to the attention of his audience, of framing it, that is, again, breaking through the clutter.
So. Right. It's almost like instead of using reason and arguments, you just use performance art or something like that. Yeah. Moving right along, I want to sort of wrap this up now with more just talking about the readers of The Nation. In your book, you describe a lady from Abbeville, Louisiana. She wanted to find a community of Nation people.
Yeah. I came back to my office one day, and I found this message on my voicemail. And I'm going to read you the message because I wrote it down when I got it. She said, I need to ask a favor of you. I'm stuck in Abbeville, Louisiana, and I want to move. It occurs to me that you might be able to rummage up a place where people are actually subscribers to The Nation, where I would have somebody to talk to. I don't want their names or anything. I just want a town where there are a few kindred souls. And then she added, if you could call around noon, I'd be grateful. I'm about to cut the grass. And the point about that message to me was there are people for whom a magazine like The Nation is a lifeline. And a lot of people tend to think of it because we're located in New York as a New York magazine and that's where our influence is, and that's wrong. As it happens, we have more readers on the West Coast than on the East Coast. But in fact, they're scattered all over the country. And the smaller the town is, person lives in, the more important the magazine is to them, because the local paper doesn't cover national and international issues for the most part, and the national media that do cover those issues, they don't trust. And this, for some folk, becomes a form of identity.
So could you give a profile of the typical nation reader?
No. let's see. The readers of magazines like The Nation, the quality of these readers gives them a great deal more influence than their numbers. There are two kinds of readers, if we're going to oversimplify. One are the historic constituency of a journal of opinion. They are people who are interested in ideas. They are the people who write the nightly news or who read it. They are members of Congress or people who work for members of state, local legislatures. They are teachers. They're people who have more influence on the culture than the average citizen, on the one hand. The second constituency we have is movement activists. These are people who are out there working, protesting, demonstrating. But also, you know, like, take a magazine like The New Republic. In their literature for their media kit, they boast about the number of readers they have who are on corporate boards. Our readers are not, for the most part, on corporate boards, but they are on the local library board, the local school board, the local housing commission, the NAACP. They are community activists. And so people interested in ideas and activists. Now, having said that, last year we got something like 28,000 new subscribers who came to us through our free website on the internet, www.thenation.com, and they're younger. And we do a lot of things over the web. For my book, I have my own book website, A Matter of Opinion by VictorNovasky.com. The Nation has its website, and it's a very important add-on to the communication.
So basically, the magazine itself is not then being obliterated by all the blogging and those kind of opinions.
Well, a lot of people thought that would happen to magazines like this. In our case, it's less like the talking movies, which obliterated silent movies. It's more like the paperback extended the audience for the hardcover book. This has extended not only the audience, but the possibility of having a conversation, and also it's made it easier for people to find the magazine through the web. You know, we do put up free content on the web, but they're not satisfied with that. They want the whole magazine. They want it in the portable form that they can carry it around. And it's sold on newsstands and in bookstores, but not all of them, and it's very hard to get effective distribution for a small circulation publication.
Yeah, and the magazine is in the black for the first time in years and doing very well. And yet so many magazines have come and gone, and it's 140 years, and The Nation is still here. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, you know, for years I would go around and I would say the secret of the nation's success, and in the magazine business, survival is the ultimate test of success. And The Nation, it is America's oldest weekly, founded in 1865, and magazines like Life and Look and Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post, with circulations in the millions, have gone under, whereas this little magazine keeps going. And I would joke and say the secret of success is it has lost money for every one of the 125 or 130 years, whatever it was. And what I meant by that was it is more a cause than a business. But it's a cause that we run like a business, on the one hand. On the other hand, if all we were a business, we'd be out of business. So we keep costs way down. It's printed on butcher paper. That's partly an economy formula that has helped it survive all these years. We don't have false circulation where we do massive mailings to build artificial circulation to impress advertisers with our numbers. It's people who really read the magazine that get it. But ultimately, it has to be performing some function for its readers. And we think we do things that, as a result of our independence, which is also the key to survival, we put new issues on the national agenda. We monitor the mainstream media, and we keep exploring alternative perspectives and have a debate that's missing from the mainstream. So
that's great.
Okay.
Okay, that's great. And I really appreciate you letting me talk to you over the phone. And I just want to thank you for sharing your opinions with KBOO Radio.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. Okay.
Bye. And I've been speaking with Victor Novasky, former editor and now publisher of Nation magazine, and author of the book, A Matter of Opinion. This is Stephanie Potter with KBOO.